You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the Friday News Roundup. President Biden announces a student loan forgiveness program. In Florida, voters pick a former governor to take on the current one. And the tracks of a 15-foot dinosaur are revealed in Texas. Those stories and more today at 6 on the 1A Weekly News Roundup. Now, the Biden administration on Wednesday took at least a bite out of the roughly $1.6 trillion in cumulative federal student loan debt. The president announced loan forgiveness of between $10,000 and $20,000, depending on the current salary of debt holders and whether or not they'd received a Pell Grant. We're going to look at how this would all work, what effects it might have, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this move, good idea or not? Does it have an effect on you personally? Are you not sure if it affects you personally and you want to find out? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nicholas Hillman is a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. He directs the Student Success through Applied Research Lab at UW. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, there have been calls for no debt forgiveness, calls for complete debt forgiveness. On the scale of none to all, where does this fit in, big picture?
It fits kind of in a sweet spot, really, right in the middle of the two, because it is not such widespread forgiveness that it makes more conservative members of Congress too worrisome, I suppose. Or maybe, well, they might still be very worrisome, but it's not too much from that vantage point. But then on the farther left end of the political distribution among progressives, it wasn't enough. And so the $10,000 for most borrowers and then up to 20 for borrowers who had a Pell Grant was kind of a compromise.
Can you talk about the debt forgiveness part of it in particular? Give us some more of the details, 10 for some, 20,000 for others, but there's also an income cap. Can you talk us through the basics of who is going to be affected by this?
There are two different things to keep in mind. One is certainly the income cap. If you're an individual with an annual income of $125,000 or less, then you would qualify. If you're in a household that has $250,000 or less, then you would qualify. So that's the first condition. But the second condition is whether you have a direct loan. And so if you took out a loan basically since 2010 forward, those are typically going to be direct loans. But there's some old loans that have been out there for a very long time prior to 2010 that might not qualify. So the first step is also to make sure you have an eligible loan.
Do you have a sense of, on a practical level, how people start finding out if they're eligible and start requesting this debt forgiveness?
Right. So there are two different places to go. One is directly to the federal government, the U.S. Department of Education. The website has been overloaded the last couple of days, so you might have to be patient to get the website to load. But the U.S. Department of Education, the Office of Federal Student Aid is the place to go there. You could log in and check your records, or you could go in through what's called a student loan servicer. So some servicers that might be familiar are Great Lakes or Navient. These servicers are the ones who are supposed to be kind of the connector between the federal government and the borrower.
Talking to Nicholas Hillman from UW-Madison, looking at the Biden administration announcement of some student loan debt forgiveness. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that decision, your questions about what it is, how it works, maybe what it means for you. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Now, that debt forgiveness is kind of the high profile part of this. There's also from the Department of Education a transition to something called income driven repayment plans. What does that mean? How does it work?
Well, the Department of Education has had different types of income driven repayment plans over the years, and each new iteration, they become a little bit more generous. Basically, what these do is they connect your monthly student loan payment to your earnings. And they cap that amount to a certain level. And so the new proposal or the new income-driven repayment plan that was just announced this week would cap monthly payments to 5% of what's called your discretionary income. Discretionary income is just basically income above the poverty level, plus or minus some other proportion. But that's the idea, is that they're going to cap monthly payments, but also, more generous than other plans, this will forgive certain loans after 10 years of making payments. In some of the other income-driven plans that exist, those forgiveness programs are 20 or 25 years later. So hopefully that helps give an idea of what these are.
Now, we have a lot of student loan debt in the United States. Can you talk about what we know about student loan debt among Wisconsin residents?
We know a few things. For example, there are about 700,000 Wisconsin residents with direct loans, the federal loans that are going to be eligible here for this cancellation. So about 700,000 people, and they carry about $21 billion in student loan debt. That adds up to about a $31,000 on average is what a student debt holder has in the state of Wisconsin.
How did we get here? Big picture, what changed in higher education funding priorities, higher education costs that drove this increase in student loan debt over the last couple few decades?
Yeah, there's a whole mix of things. On one hand, the expenses of college, the tuition and the room and the board, just the expenses of going to college has continued to rise over the past 20, 30 years. In fact, it's doubled just since the 90s and even higher in some places. So that's a big part of it. Another part of it, though, that makes college more expensive on the first hand. But another part of it is that family incomes haven't really grown as fast. And so individuals can't just pay out of pocket for college, so they have to rely on student loans. Another side to this, though, is that the federal and state financial aid programs that are designed to reduce those price barriers by giving out grants and scholarships, those haven't kept pace either. And so you kind of have this mix of a situation where, more borrowers are relying on loans over time. They're relying on more loans to pay for college. And it doesn't help that the interest rates that are accrued in loan programs have also been rising. So we have a whole kind of slew of issues that have created this ballooning amount of student loan debt now nationally of almost $1.7 trillion.
Bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Vivian is with us in Brown County. Vivian, hi.
Hi. It's been a while, but I was going to bring up the interest rate as well as the fact that some loans aren't wiped out even through bankruptcy. But the interest rates, when my daughter was looking for loans and I was comparing those, I said, that's just silly. They're more than mortgage rates. And why are they like that? She reminded me she had no collateral, obviously. So I think the structure of the loans, the interest rates, I wonder of that total that you mentioned for total student loan debt, how much of that is interest?
Vivian, thanks for the call. Nick, the structure of these loans, Vivian says, has been a problem.
That's right. To answer that last question with a non-answer, we don't know how much of the outstanding debt is interest versus principal. So that's part of the challenge. Some things that the Biden administration has been working on is to put caps on the amount of interest that can accumulate. So that should at least address part of the problem. But I think a bigger problem, and Vivian mentioned this, saying that this thing about no collateral, unlike most any other loans that people take out in America, there's collateral. If you take out a car loan, the repossession man will come to your house and take the car away if you don't make your payments. Or, there's something to be taken away. But for education, that's not the case. They can't take your education away from you. And so because of that, it's a really unconventional type of way to finance an education. And it's based off of a model that was designed in the 1950s and 60s that may have worked, and maybe we're realizing today that this type of financing system isn't quite aligned with how human nature works.
Thanks for that call, Vivian. Don joins us now in Janesville. Don, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm kind of getting on board with Vivian. My girlfriend's Pell Grant is about $12,500, from almost 20 years ago. And the interest is about $62,000. So I was just wondering, is this if it goes through and they take, they wash the primary money away, does the interest go away too, or do you know how that's going to work out? How is that going to happen?
Interesting, Don. Thanks for the call, Nick.
That is a great question because there are a lot of unknowns at this point. I assume that it would be the principal and the interest outstanding. I would assume that that is what is going to be covered, but that has not been explicit in the press releases and the announcements that I've been reading. I've been keeping up with this week. So they haven't been really explicit about that difference, I would assume, but gosh, that should be clear.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison, looking at the announcement earlier this week from President Biden that the administration is canceling from $10,000 to $20,000 of federal student loan debt for borrowers who make under a certain amount of money. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about that move? Too much? Not enough? Does it affect you? Do you have questions? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about President Biden's announcement earlier this week about canceling a substantial portion of student loan debt. Nick Hillman stays with us, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to the announcement, your questions about it. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Allison is with us in Stevens Point. Allison, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, so my understanding, because I have an income-based repayment plan for my student loans, my understanding was that whatever amount of my loan is then forgiven after the 20-year period that they have me set up for will be that year added as income on my taxes. So say I have $20,000 left on my student loan, and that's forgiven, that $20,000 then would be added to my income for that year for tax purposes. So I was wondering, does anyone know if this forgiveness of $10,000 or $20,000 is going to affect people's income taxes for this year?
Allison, thanks for that call. Nick, please correct me if I'm wrong. I believe I saw that the forgiven debt under this policy would not be treated as taxable income. But again, correct me if I'm wrong.
You are correct, Rob. Yes, that's correct. The American Rescue Plan was passed last year, and in it, there's a provision that said that student debts that are going to be canceled until 2025, it expires in 2025, are not going to be counted as income on your taxes.
Thanks for the call, Allison. We'll go now to Greg with us in Sheboygan. Greg, hi.
I have a question, and I have a comment. When I first started in college, right after I got out of high school, I'm 68 years old, I spent $600 a semester, and that was two paychecks because it was 12-something an hour where I worked making level-air truck seats at Bostrom in Milwaukee. But and then it went up to I think 900 when I in 89, and now I went back for heating and air conditioning just to check the difference between standard and metric. I mean, heating and air conditioning is standard basically, and it was $2,400 just for a semester. And I want to know why the teaching didn't differ. I don't know what is the cost. Why? How? Now, if you paid the teachers, they'd be all making $1 million. I mean.
Greg, I gotcha. Nick, Greg's experience, not unusual, that increase in costs happening in a lot of places.
Greg, I'm smiling over here because you're tapping on just a big fundamental problem that we're still trying to resolve, and it doesn't seem to be fixed. So we had an era of high wages and low tuition, you mentioned, Greg. And now we have an era of low wages and high tuition. We have just the opposite. And so the tuition continues to rise, especially in the public sector for a lot of factors. But one large one is state investment in public higher education has either flattened off or not grown very quickly, or in many cases declined. And so the cost gets passed on to the consumer via higher tuition. So that's one part of the puzzle, but that doesn't explain everything. The other part of the puzzle, or one of the other parts, I suppose, is that the whole entire enterprise of higher education. You think of universities and colleges and technical schools, they hire a lot of professional staff members, a lot of professionalized workers, and those salaries have not gone down over time. Those salaries have to be competitive with how salaries are rising in the private sector. And so those are all the conditions that kind of give rise to high tuition.
Greg, thanks a lot for calling in. And I got to say, Greg reminds me, Nick, that I think a lot of the conversation I see about this imagines a college student as somebody who goes to a four-year residential campus with ivy on the brick buildings and so on. Greg is an HVAC student. There are a lot of students out there who might have student loans for a wide variety of reasons.
That is absolutely right. And in fact, one of the things that is surprising to me is that students who have smaller loans, maybe enrolled in just a short period of time, maybe didn't even finish a credential, but now they don't have that to pay off in the labor force. And sometimes those low loan levels are actually the ones that students or borrowers struggle the most with. So they tend to default on their loans. And so the Biden administration is also working on clearing those defaulted loans. 7.5 million borrowers who are in default on relatively small loans are going to have their loans be put into good standing and potentially forgiven too.
Greg, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Talking to Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison, looking at the Biden administration announcement on student loan debt. Back to your calls now. Pat is with us in Three Lakes. Pat, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I've got a question. How much of the student loans, what's the percentage are financed by private lenders versus government? And also, on the $10,000 and the $20,000, what happens to the private lender? Are they just out the $10,000?
Pat, thanks for the call. Nick, so two-parter here, private versus publicly funded or backed loans. Do we know how much is in each category there?
Less than 10% of the dollar volume of that $1.7 trillion I mentioned earlier, $1.6 trillion, about 10% of that is from private student loans. And those are usually lent out by banks or credit unions and so on.
And then Pat's second question, I guess, does this loan forgiveness apply to those loans that someone might have gotten from a bank or credit union?
It does not. So the debt cancellation that the Biden administration announced is for these federal loans.
Pat, thanks for calling in. Good questions at 800-642-1234. Anita joins us now in Lindenhurst. Anita, hello.
Hi, good talk. Now, I don't disapprove of helping out the student debt, but I think that before we went and gave it out to all everybody that has a loan, I think priority should have been given to all of those, what would you call them, the nurses and the doctors and the EMTs and the staff that worked treating COVID patients during the very worst days of COVID. And they didn't get to see their kids, their families, because they couldn't bring COVID home. They couldn't risk it.
Anita, thanks a lot for the call. Nick, I understand there were already, I believe, some forgiveness plans for people who worked in, I think, healthcare, maybe teachers and some other professions. And I think in this new guidance from the Biden administration, they're trying to make it easier for people in those categories to actually get that kind of debt forgiveness.
That's correct. There is a specific program, and listen for this term, Public Service Loan Forgiveness, PSLF. And what that does is if you make payments for 10 years, then you can have whatever's remaining, principal and interest, canceled after that period of time. And the Biden administration has made some changes to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. It's sort of a temporary fix right now that gives more generous benefits. So it counts more time for borrowers to sort of have their debt forgiven. But they're going to try to make that more permanent. So public service loan forgiveness is one way to do it. I think, though, that the caller, and forgive me, I forgot your name, it taps into this question of who deserves it. And I think the politics of all of this are certainly right there in our face.
Thanks for that call, Anita. Sandra joins us now in Mount Pleasant. Sandra, hello.
Hi. Many people think this is something novel and new, but it isn't really. Back in the late 60s, I was in a four-year college in an education program, and I received a national defense loan, and albeit much, much smaller than what we're hearing of people owing today. But after I taught X amount of years, I only had to pay back half of the loan.
Interesting, Sandra. So Sandra's saying there's some precedent, Nick, for this kind of thing.
That is absolutely right. And that's something I've been thinking on as well. So is this kind of returning the loan program to its origins? Maybe so. Yes, absolutely. The national defense loans. And then over time, there have been several other service-oriented loans that get forgiven after a period of time. So yes, this is there's definitely precedence.
Thanks for that call, Sandra. Nick, I want to take our last minute or so to talk about, okay, some of this older debt is forgiven, but students are going back, you know, to school in the next few days and racking up new debt. Are there solutions in the works for, you know, not racking up that debt that we'll be talking about in 10 years?
There's not really a long-term solution here. And that's, I think, a big challenge with this. Now, yes, it benefits people immediately who took out loans prior to July 1, 2022. So if your loan was disbursed before that date, then you could be eligible. But after that date, you're not. And so it leaves a lot of big question marks about what's next. What about everybody else? And how are we going to solve these problems so that this doesn't happen again in the future?
That's where we'll leave it. Nick, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
Nicholas Hillman is a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about this week's announcement that the Biden administration will be canceling between $10,000 and $20,000 of student loan debt for certain borrowers. We want to hear your story about student loan debt, especially if this change affects you or doesn't affect you and you're wondering why. Head over to WPR.org and search for the Why Sconson page, that's W-H-Y Sconson, and share your story there. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, Wisconsin has had a long-running shortage of public defenders. A new lawsuit says that's causing harm to defendants in the state. We'll find out what's driving that problem and look at some possible solutions along the way. Plus, we heard earlier this summer the Republican National Convention is going to come to Milwaukee in 2 years. Milwaukee's mayor, Cavalier Johnson, is going to join the show on Monday with a look at the possible economic impact. Plus, a preview of the November elections. Now that primary season is pretty much done, that's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, pandemic school closures and the shift to virtual schooling had a big impact on children's lives in the U.S. We may not see the full effects for years to come. We'll talk to the author of the new book, The Stolen Year, about what that impact looks like and how the U.S. approach to school during the pandemic compared to other countries. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a trip through the creative mind of a New Orleans chef on this week's edition of Food Friday. First, when schools closed down in the early days of the pandemic, it had a big effect on kids' lives and the lives of the people who take care of them. Kids had to change how they learned. Many of them couldn't see their friends, and that didn't just affect their learning. It had an impact on their mental health. Our next guest reported on education for years. She says the U.S. fell short when it came to caring for kids during the pandemic, and she says that was a symptom of a longer-term problem. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have kids who had to go through school closures and virtual learning, or you were one of those kids yourself, what was it like? What shortfalls did you see? Where did you see things falling behind? Have you caught up since then, or are you still working on it? If you work in education, what are you seeing now with the kids in your classrooms? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Anya Kamenetz covered education for NPR for 8 years. She's the author of the new book, The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. Anya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to take us back to the early days of the pandemic. You were an education reporter. You'd reported on how disasters affected kids and learning. What was going through your mind in terms of hopes and fears of what would happen when school started to close?
So when school shut down in New York City and all over the world in mid-March of 2020, I was home in my home office. I had two daughters who were 3 and 8 years old at the time. And I had been in New Orleans just a few weeks after Katrina and seen how the upending of kids' lives with schools closed in that city for a few months really had long-lasting ripple impacts. And so I kind of knew that school closures were going to be a really big deal for American kids, but none of us, of course, could have imagined that they would go on so long.
You are hopeful, I think, that some of the lessons learned from Katrina and those school closures would give us some guideposts on what to do when schools close because of the pandemic. What did you hope we might have taken out of that maybe we didn't?
I mean, it was really about the fact that there were so many underlying inequities. There are so many kids living in poverty and dealing with the effects of systemic racism and the lack of social supports in our country, not only in Louisiana, but all over the country. And so I really was astonished to see that while our leaders talked a lot about kind of the fact that there were a lot of kids out there that were needy, we didn't do what it took to actually make up for the loss of school. There were a lot of hard efforts made to give out school lunch, sandwiches in parking lots and drive around hotspots and computers, but the real problems were not being addressed. And as the closures went on and on, especially in blue states, I think it was really shocking to me and to a lot of people that were watching.
The heart of your book is your reporting with families experiencing this in real time. You were on Zoom or a comparable thing with some of your informants over the years. Can you introduce us to a couple of the families you met and what they experienced?
Sure. So Jeannie lives in rural Oklahoma, and her family are members of the Cherokee Nation. And she is a teacher who really took refuge in school as a kid growing up when times were tough. And it was that same school where she taught, where all five of her children attended. And so when school shut down, it was the loss of, she said, of a safe place for her and for many people in her community that she said suffered the effects of childhood trauma. Her own children had a real range of reactions to the pandemic. And it really shows how, there's so many different impacts across kids all over the country. In California, I profiled a family that had a son with autism, dyslexia, ADHD, and really, really struggled with remote learning, was very explosive. And that family, on top of that, took on an emergency foster care brother, a young boy who was best friends with their son and was a recent immigrant from Southeast Asia. So then they had basically these two kids growing up together, and both of them struggling with remote learning in their own ways.
You compare and contrast the response in the U.S. and our schools here to countries around the world. What did you see different from between the U.S. and especially more other industrial countries when it came to how they prioritized their kids and their schools?
Yeah, I think that's just such an important question. You know, obviously, we all would wish that we would be New Zealand or South Korea and countries that just limited transmission and were able to reopen schools with no controversy and without the loss of life. But where I really think the contrast gets sharp is with countries like the UK, France, Israel, Italy, Spain, and Scandinavia, where they started reopening schools in the spring of 2020. And certainly by the fall of 2020, there was a very strong commitment on the part of the European equivalent of the CDC, as well as the World Health Organization, in saying that closing schools in all cases should be a last resort. And what that meant in practice was that when subsequent waves of the disease came in the fall of 2020, all the way into 2021, these countries were willing to close bars and restaurants and public facilities while keeping schools open as an essential service. And that's exactly what we didn't do in the United States.
Talking to Anya Kamenetz, her new book is called The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share, how did COVID change your children's lives? How did school closures affect their ability to learn? Do you feel like they've caught up? If you're one of the kids who had that weird lost year plus during a school closure during COVID, love to hear from you what you thought of the experience, what worked, what didn't work. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. A big part of the story, Anya, of course, remote schooling, remote learning. How did you see that falling short, especially for some of the families you talked to?
So I really want to acknowledge that teachers worked incredibly hard. They changed everything about their job on a dime. And they tried really hard to reach students, but there were so many obstacles. Obviously, basic connectivity, you know, many, many parents reported not having reliable internet, having too many people in a small space, I think we can all relate to, or not having the equipment that they needed. And even if they did, there were many places where kids, you know, turned off their cameras, really disengaged. You know, being truant used to involve, you know, getting up and leaving school, but during remote learning, all it took was clicking to another browser window. And even in my circle of friends and family, I heard so many stories of kids that were absentee, were watching YouTube or playing Minecraft, and it took weeks sometimes for the school to notify anyone.
You talked to some experts on education as well in the course of writing the book. What do we know about bouncing back from some of the learning loss that those kids you're talking about might have experienced?
Sure. I mean, you know, learning trajectories are totally individual. And so, you know, we can't make sweeping generalizations. We can say on average that in terms of math scores, in terms of reading scores, it's going to take years. The latest numbers kind of suggest that for elementary school students, on average, it would take 3 years to recover the learning trajectory you would expect them to be on. Starting in 2019. There are some states and localities where they really have redoubled their efforts and added extra resources, and kids are catching up a little bit faster than that. But years is the correct expectation, I think, overall.
You make the case throughout the book, I think, Anya, that the pandemic was an acute symptom of a chronic problem in how we value children and how we prioritize children. Can you talk about what you see the pandemic exposing that we could have seen as problems for years, even leading up to it?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you asked that. And it was really, truly bewildering to me because I was like, okay, progressives care about kids. Like, that's what they do. You know, they care about families. And yet here we are sitting in the middle of this catastrophe, and somehow we're missing the mark. We're not prioritizing children. We're letting other things take precedence. And then you start to look around and you realize, why is it this country, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, is one of the only wealthy countries that doesn't have subsidized childcare, doesn't have paid leave, doesn't have any kind of income supplement, which other rich countries do to prevent child poverty. We have more children growing up in poverty than members of any other age group. So let that sink in. How did we allow that to happen? We have Social Security for the elderly and no compensation for families with kids. And it's the deep historical reasons behind that and sort of the exceptionalism in the United States that the historical parts of the book try to explore.
We're talking to Anya Kamenetz, previously a longtime education reporter at NPR, author of the new book, The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your personal experiences as a parent, a student, a teacher. How did the school closures in particular affect learning, socializing, mental and emotional well-being? How have things gone since school came back into session? What are you thinking as you head into a new school year? Big picture, do you think we kept schools closed too long in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Anya Kamenetz about her new book. It's called The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your memories, your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to our callers now. Angela is with us in Waukesha. Angela, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, you know, we know that the educational experience is really different depending on where students and families were, even within the same state. So the school that I teach at, we didn't close in the fall. We had the short closure in the spring, but we were back up and running in the fall as usual, which is social distancing and mask wearing. And I'm wondering if they've looked at childhood development and educational progress for those students who really had limited online learning and were in school sort of as usual after sort of that like 2 month break in the spring, or are there other factors at play with learning loss maybe for those students? I can take my answer off there.
Angela, thanks for the call. And Anya, I'm guessing this is something that researchers are going to be researching for years to come. But do we have thoughts, do we have inklings on what the difference might have been for those kids who came back to school in fall of 2020 versus those who stayed virtual?
Yeah, that's a really great point the caller brought up, because there were many places around the country where schools did reopen with various degrees of restrictions in the fall of 2020. And basically, the longer kids were in remote, the more learning impacts that we're seeing. That's in the test scores this year. So that's the general overview. We're also seeing some indications that prolonged remote learning had more social and emotional impacts on students as well. There were obviously lots of interruptions in education, not only in the 2020-2021 school year, but also in the school year just ended. There was Omicron, there were personnel shortages, and there were quarantines that sent kids home. So there's a lot of what was called, you know, normally in normal times we call chronic absenteeism, but, you know, if you're sending kids home for a 10-day quarantine, which happens in a lot of places, that was also a blow as well. So people are really in a lot of different places. It's really all over the place. But the shorthand response is the less remote learning, the more kids were able to stay on track.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Leanne is with us in Madison. Leanne, hello.
Hi. I said to your telephone person, I don't think the question is so much about what, you know, the question is, what should we do now? Because we've come up with lots of concerns about schooling. Your previous person just talked about how critical it is to have a person involved in this, not to do everything online, not to do everything, you know, on a computer and remotely. We've got to do some rethinking about this, and how are we going to involve communities, parents, you know, the whole family in educating our kids and making them the priority that they deserve to be.
Leanne, thanks for the call. That takes us to the last part of your subtitle, Anya. Where we go now?
Absolutely. You know, I guess a bright spot here is that schools received, you know, depending on how you count, about $122 billion in federal funding, which actually is a lot of money. Schools spend a lot of money, so big numbers don't always mean a lot, but this is a lot of money. They have till 2024 in most cases to spend it. And they are. They're spending on an extra learning time, a lot of summer programs, tutoring, and social and emotional learning, because I think everybody agrees, teachers and parents will tell you that they're more concerned about students' well-being than they are about, you know, numbers on a test score that can get ameliorated gradually over time, although they're both important. So schools are making the effort. There's a couple of headwinds, though. Obviously, we've heard a lot about staffing shortages. And some of that is, you know, the labor market we're in, the great resignation. Some of it is the emotional headwinds and the burnout a lot of teachers are expressing, and trying to fill up that pipeline, you know, with qualified folks, especially in areas like special education, especially in counselors. So this is a really big issue. Where are those people going to come from? The other big issue is that there's headwinds as far as enrollment. So enrollment dropped historically during the pandemic. The only time we've seen it in modern times was during World War II, when high school students left because of the war effort and the work situation then. So there were so many students left public schools, and demographics are showing a continuing decline in public school enrollment because of immigration and birth rates. So you look at a long-term future of fewer students in public schools, how do we manage the resources that we have? Because we tend to fund our schools based on headcount. And so how do we make sure that schools stay enriched and stay abundant in the resources to help the students that are there?
Thanks for that call, Leanne, at 800-642-1234. Anya Kamenetz is with us talking about her new book. It's called The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you want to share your experience, what you're seeing in schools now as a student, parent, or teacher, solutions, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Anya, I wanted to talk in particular about students with various kinds of special needs. You mentioned one of the families you talked to in California. How were they in particular affected by school closures?
Really detrimentally. I mean, there were a few students who, for example, that it's ADHD or social anxiety that had some successes with remote learning. But for the most part, families told me that their students really suffered without access to the interventions and the therapies that they're used to getting. Zoom just was not an effective way to deliver a lot of those interventions and therapies. A lot of students actually regressed. They fell behind in their development. And so there's a lot of calls for compensation and really a big need to update students' plans so that they get the services that they need. And just everywhere I look, I hear about families that are really struggling to get students the help that they need right now.
Flipping things around, a lot of the students we were just talking about might have something called an IEP, I think Individualized Educational Plan. You float the idea in the book, or maybe you're quoting somebody else, I can't remember, but the idea of not just them, every student having an individualized educational plan, given that one size doesn't always fit all. What might that look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's really an exciting idea. And I think there have been people talking about it for a long time, but particularly now, because I think one of the silver linings of remote learning is that as parents, we got to know our children's learning styles on a lot more intimate level than we may have before. And so how do we build on that? And how do we ensure that each child is getting the learning that they need after kind of being on their own trajectories during remote learning? This would take resources. It would take using the resources that we have differently. But we certainly know that one size fits all is not the best model for kids, especially in this, you know, kind of fast moving, complex society that we're in.
Another issue you spent a chapter on in the book actually is childcare, a problem before the pandemic, a problem now in these, you know, 2 or 3 years in. Can you talk about what happened with the childcare crisis in the midst of the pandemic?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, as much as we talk about the school closure crisis, childcare is such a fragmented field. It's actually one of this experts I said, you know, said it's like it's exaggerating to call it a system because we have people taking in, you know, kids into their homes. We have Head Start centers that don't serve enough. We have private daycares that pay very low wages without subsidies and are still extremely expensive for families. During the pandemic, some of those areas, some of them shut down. Others kept operating, but they really had very little centralized guidance about how to do so safely. So there was a lot of nervousness. They had to close all the time. I mean, it was a very long time before there were vaccines available for this age group. So it was a big mess. A lot of people left the field and were not able to be hired back because if you can get $25 an hour or $20 an hour working at Costco or an Amazon warehouse and a childcare center where you're holding babies all day is $12 an hour, it's going to be very, very hard. So there's childcare deserts. And federal subsidy programs, which were on the table with Build Back Better, have evaporated. So people, advocates are really saying, we need help here. Something's got to give.
Time for one more caller. Danny is with us in Green Bay. Danny, hi.
Hi, guys. Great topic. Yeah, I just wanted to chime in and concur with your guest. When I was starting teaching, my mentor was a special ed teacher. And I was very blessed because I learned to approach all the kids the way special ed teachers approach their kids and to try to individualize curriculum because, as your guest said, every kid learns in a different way.
Danny, thanks for the call. Are you hopeful, Anya, that coming out of this pandemic, we can learn some lessons, maybe rethink the basics that we were doing before the pandemic in ways that you mentioned and that Danny was just talking about?
I think there's opportunities to do it, but you know, you don't innovate coming out of a defensive crouch. And so the more that schools feel kind of beleaguered by these fights over things like CRT or, you know, LGBTQ rights, the less they feel like they're in a space where they can really think differently and think expansively. I know there are some school leaders out there that are keeping their eyes on the prize and that are trying to innovate. But we kind of need to give them a little more help and grace so that they can do it.
Thanks for the call, Danny. Anya, just in our last half a minute, after working with these families over the course of more than a year, you got to meet them in person briefly. What was it like?
It was incredible. It was so emotional. You know, I drove from St. Louis to rural Oklahoma to meet two of my families. And I also flew out to California and obviously New York, Washington, D.C. And just, you know, seeing the kids, and this was April 21, and you know, people were vaccinated and being able to be there in person, you know, what you see is that even if a family on paper is really struggling, and I heard so much about the hard times, When you get into the room with someone, you see the love that's there, you see the care that they have for each other and the optimism for the future. I mean, that's really what it's all about.
Anya, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
That was Anya Kamenetz, author of the new book, The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. We've got a link to info about the book online at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, a New Orleans-based chef talks about his new cookbook on this edition of Food Friday with a focus on some creative sandwich making. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.